soundtrack, Living Memory, an account of the Irish experience of Britain.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're delighted to be here this afternoon. Age Exchange Theatre Company have been working very hard since I last met the group who meet here on Friday afternoons for your reminiscences about Ireland and your other discussions that you have about life today. And
so we build the Mersey Tunnel, the subway and the docks. For women, beer and income tax, we're always on the rock. Go into any hospital, Liverpool, Manchester, there's an Irish nurse you see there. Go out on the building site where any big building is done, it's Irish. What do they do with them in this country? They're making it today, and
my father told me about his childhood and poaching salmon and the way they'd escape from the Brits, you know. I think he instilled in me, because of his own love of Ireland, of its beauty. And he used to say to me, why, in the midst of the most beautiful place in the world, has there been so much bloodshed and tragedy?
And last time I came to you, I told you that we wanted to interview a lot of people about their experiences of living in Ireland as children and of coming over here and starting a new life, what had happened to you, and how you'd settled, and what your feelings were about Ireland now, looking back.
And we'd like people who are now in their 60s and 70s are in the process of reevaluating their lives, and perhaps when they're looking back, there's a surprising clarity and sharpness about their young days. There's a desire to take stock, and to do that, perhaps you need to go back to your earliest days and think about where you've come from.
Presented our reading of the play for you, we will be wanting to talk to you and find out, well, where was it right, where was it wrong? Most of the people I've spoken to are in fact reflected somewhere in the play that you're going to see. A play which, for the moment at least, is called Across the Irish Sea. Little town called Kildorrery in Southern Ireland, County Cork. Beautiful it was. We had one room and a large kitchen. It was in a little gate lodge.
Our father worked as a saddler on the estate of a wealthy English family. Now, all the big houses were occupied by English people. He looked after the horses for them. Oh, he'd take those horses from one fair to another, and when he delivered them, he'd walk back. Father often walked 40 miles in one day after delivering those horses.
I was the youngest of 8 children, 6 boys and 2 girls. There were 2 beds in the room, and we slept with children in the foot and the head, and someone had to sleep in the bed with my parents.
And we had what was called a settle bed, which was one that was a seat in the daytime and opened out into a bed which had the mattress and the blankets and things inside. And young children slept either end, so it held 4 people. So that way we all slept.
When we were very little, if you put in the room, we were supposed to be in bed, but we were sitting up listening. There were a lot of the old Irish songs.
Oh, our family loved music, and they loved singing. My father was able to play a concertina and a melodeon, so even if the nights were long, we didn't mind.
Oh, my father had some lovely old songs. One was, oh, have you been to Avondale? He sang that beautifully. And so people would always ask, you know,
come on, Dan, give us Avondale.
And so he would sing.
Oh, have you been to Avondale and wandered in her lovely vale?
That was my earliest memory, you know, from childhood.
Of Avondale's proud eagle.
The idea for this particular play came really from my own experience that I was brought up in Manchester in a Jewish household, but I was looked after quite a lot of the time by an Irish maid who was a great friend to me, and we used to do a lot of things together, including going on bicycle rides and walks and so on, and she was a good talker and a good storyteller, and I hugely enjoyed listening to her memories of her childhood in Ireland and growing up and the family and the homestead and so on. And also I loved her songs, Irish songs and ballads, and I would enjoy sitting on her knee mainly and listening to these stories and songs. And I think it was the difference from my own upbringing which I found made her life so fascinating to me.
The family my father worked for sold off their house in the country and moved into the city. And the new people took over, called Hodgins. Now they were what we called black Protestants. They were very bitter people. And this Hodgins used to go around on his big horse. And I'm not exaggerating that if you were on the road and you didn't more or less jump up on the ditch when he and his horses passed by, he whipped you. I remember getting a crack at that whip. The IRA had burnt down some of their property because, you see, they were involved in recruiting for the British Army around here. Now, my father would have nothing whatsoever to do with those burnings, but all the families on the estate were identified more or less with the Republican movement.
Tramp, 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 the boys are marching. Who's that knocking at the door?
Well, in that area, in those days, I think you'd travel a long way before you'd find a family that didn't have nationalistic opinions.
At that time, too, in Ireland, there was a lot of fascism, and I grew up going all round. I remember when I was a young fella, there was meetings and all this, but then in the 1930s, there was an economic war going on with Britain, which was, oh, blimey, it was terrible. We had a small farm, but a little cattle you had, there was no price for them because this economic war was hitting everyone, and while the family was nothing for it but for them to immigrate.
Now, obviously, poverty was very rife. The economic situation was absolutely appalling. When I say poverty, I don't mean everybody was going around looking like Ethiopians, but abject poverty. People who never had anything new to wear, who may have a meal, main meal once a week. People walking 5 miles to school with no shoes of any kind. I don't know whether people have been hardened to it. In my own childhood, the first new dress I ever had was for my first communion.
You made your first communion when you were 7. Me mom's sister was living in America and she sent me a lovely, beautiful frock. Oh, it was a lovely frock. I was so proud, you know. It was all lace. There was a lace cape, no sleeves, but lace cape, and it was all beautiful. A wreath and a veil, shoes and all. I got the whole set and I felt so lovely.
The nuns had us all coached up. Prayers here and prayers there. Well, they'd keep you in the evening, some evenings, you know, and put you through the ropes of how to do it, so to say, as a priest, and how to go to confession, and how to tell your sins, and your catechism, and all this sort of stuff. So we learned all the catechism, the penny catechism that time. And everything was in it, as good as it is today. Anything I learned, I still go by it.
Who made you?
God made me.
Why did God make you?
God made me to know him, to love him, to serve him in this world, and to be happy with him forever and ever.
And then the next morning, when you make your first communion, the priest shall ask you whatever question he wants to ask you, and you have to know it all up.
That would have been a crime if you were to make a mistake.
And then the nuns give you a party, you see, things like jelly and custard and cakes. And the mothers would be allowed to watch, and everybody said, oh, my little girl is prettier than your little girl. And you walked around in your style all day, and old ladies and old sinners, and that they gave you money, not because you were having your communion, but to say a prayer for them, because they believed that would absolve them and help them on their way to heaven. So obviously you wore the dress as long as you could all day. You had this little prayer your mother made. You ended up with quite a lot of money, and if it was enough, you gave it to your mother, so you would all have a nice meal for a week. So praying went on for a long time, but as you got all this money, did you mind praying all day?
So
talking about the how good the dead person was, the part they played in the Irish freedom struggle.
I haven't got that with my script in my hand yet.
Don't worry about that. What I was suggesting.
There wasn't a great deal of time for rehearsal. Well, I was very lucky to have a very quick learning cast, very intelligent and committed performers, who also were keen to have an input to the text, and they studied the interview material. Everybody had to listen to the tapes of the people whose experience they were reflecting, even though they, in some cases, didn't meet those people. But they met them through the sound of their voices and the inflection. And of the three actors, I suppose, each actor's character was an amalgam of four or five different interviewees, at least. So they had to listen to several different voices. And that was an important part of the process of identifying with the material and understanding it.
If there is a freedom song that could be played on the whistle behind it, it would be lovely, because we're talking about the Wakes, and we're talking about, you know, these tremendous tributes played to these chaps, and what a surprise it is to you.
I remember the Wakes very well indeed, seeing them laid out in their beds, all white, with candles at either end. They'd get a piece of cake and bread and jam. There was always plenty of drink for the grown-ups, and always stories of how good the dead person was, and also about the part they played in the Irish freedom struggle. Oh, it was really quite exciting. I think I learned the whole history of my homeland at the Wakes.
I went to the Christian Brothers for the sake of our poverty, chastity, and obedience. I say they're male nuns, shall we say. And they're not priests, they're religious, but they're dedicated to teaching. And their child psychology was giving you a belt in the jaw if you didn't know your food. I remember one Christian brother, he was our maths teacher, and he introduced himself to us and said, when you die, and when they perform an autopsy on you, and they look at your heart, I want to find a nucleus theorem engraved on the middle of your heart. This is the psychological approach to it. It was brutal education. Let me put it that way. It was brutal in primary school. And the same place to the nuns, I believe. They were just as nasty as the girls in a more bitchy kind of a way. So you learned you learned your lessons. You were crucified. You learned through fear.
Sheer terror. That's what it was like. Now, if you went home and told your father, I got clattered today by the Christian Brothers, he gave you a clatter on the grounds that if you deserved to get it from the Christian Brothers, he was going to give you another one. Just to show you, don't do it again. Whatever you did, don't do it again.
I went to a convent school there. We were all taught for nuns. A very good teacher there. They were very dedicated. Considering the poverty there at the time, they gave us a very good, solid foundation. But of course, sex education was unknown in those days. One of the nuns called me one day and said, come along, Catherine, there's a book we've got to read. So I was taken into a room and was sat down on one side of the table. And she sat in the other with her rosary in her hand and said to me, read that book from cover to cover. And I read it from cover to cover. She never explained a thing to me. I sat there in front of her reading this book that didn't mean a thing to me. I was a facts of life.
Never, never be alone in the same room as a man. That was your sex education. When I eventually got up here, I thought I was probably dying, you know. And my mother just said, that's a monthly sickness that women get, and that's all I knew. Then girls would whisper, you can have a baby now. And I was afraid to sit beside anyone in the pictures in case I suddenly a baby. On the wedding night, I mean, I just cried for my mother, you know. And I was so completely uneducated, sexually, in any point of the word, that, you know, I knew you scared the bed, but that was it. That was all I was prepared to do. My husband, luckily I married a widower, otherwise God knows my life would be nice, and he bought me a record afterwards of I told her everything she knows.